from Hollywood, it's rated LGBT Radio, starring your host, Rob Watson!
Good evening, thank you for listening in. And for those of you who are listening to this as a podcast, welcome whatever time of day you happen to be catching us. This is Rated LGBT Radio. I am Rob Watson, and we are really thrilled that you are joining us on this important topic. And tonight, the night after the Mueller report was released in its redacted form, but released nonetheless, we are doing a post-mortem on it. And tonight my guests are two people who basically have their finger on the pulse of everything happening. And so I kind of want to not only go over the report as we understand it and everything that we can get out of it, but I'm also very interested to hear how both these folks experienced the report today. They've been in the thick of the Washington, D.C. scene and policy and everything going on in the government. And so the effect here has got to be substantial for both of them. And who are they? Well, one is our regular co-host, the esteemed journalist, Brody Levesque. And Brody has been following this, and not only following it, he was in Washington today. And so we're going to get a lot of firsthand observations of the scene there and everything that went down. And our other person on deck, who we are thrilled to welcome back to the show in a few minutes, is the analyst and author, Bryn Tannehill. Bryn is author of Everything You Want to Know About Being Trans, But We're Afraid to Ask. Tonight we're going to have her shift her hat a little bit and make this a little bit more everything you wanted to know about the Mueller report, but were afraid to ask. So without further ado, I'm going to welcome Brody Levesque to the show, and we will start tapping his brain. Good evening, Brody.
Good evening, Rob, and good evening to our listeners. Today has got to be, without a doubt, one of the strangest news days I think I have covered in the four decades that I have been a reporter. It just was surreal, and it just seemed as though it was never ending. And what was interesting was that for the first time, you actually saw the greater pool of not only just the Washington press corps and the White House press corps, but journalists from everywhere across the globe picking this report apart, picking apart things that had been said and reported on previously, making an analysis line by line, trying to do a forensic reconstruction, if you will, of the areas that were redacted to try and figure out, you know, where the meaning was to it. So in terms of journalism, today was actually a good day to be a journalist.
Wow. So Brody, I'm going to ask you a big level question first before we get into details. What of everything that you've studied about the report, the behavior of people with it coming out today, the whole rollout, the reaction, everything, what surprised you the most?
I think the thing that surprised me the most was how disingenuous the Attorney General of the United States was in terms of dealing with this. It was absolutely incredible that we had a sitting U.S. Attorney General act as though he was a defense counsel instead of the nation's top law enforcement. I mean, he literally came off as a criminal defense lawyer. That was actually a little bit of a surprise. I expected some spinning. Don't get me wrong. I expected some spinning. But I really didn't expect him to go full on syncopate, and he did. It was just amazing. He was literally Trump's toady and it was just, it was incredible. When we had an opportunity to start getting into the report, it became painfully obvious that he had literally tried to spin this any way he could to prepare the public for the reality of the report. And the reality of the report is, and, you know, I'm sure we'll get into this later, that at the end of the day, what the special counsel was able to put together over the last 2 years of their investigation more or less throws it to Congress to do an Article 2, Section 4, which is literally impeachment. I mean, there's enough in here that the House can do that if they so desire.
Yeah. Bertie, I want to ask you one more question, and then we'll bring Bryn on, and we'll go through everything together. But my question is, if I heard correctly a report today, there are going to be 8 people in Congress who will see the complete unredacted report. One, is that true? And two, who are those people?
That is true. They will be committee chairs. We fully expect that the committees will be Intelligence, Judiciary, House Appropriations. Basically, even the Speaker, these are going to be people that would be critical in making determination. I think that House Judiciary being the most important of that, of course, being Representative Nadler. So it's, you know, one of those things where we kind of half expected that.
Well, I honestly, to tell you the truth, from my perspective, I'm relieved at that, because my bigger fear prior to today was that no one would ever see that, no one that we could actually rely on to give us an accurate assessment. So at least that part to me was good news.
I think it's very good news. Representative Schiff, who chairs the intelligence committee, in his remarks in California, he was in Burbank when he made them. As you know, they are out on their Easter break, so most of the representatives and senators are out in their home districts. Schiff was really point blank about it. The bottom line with Representative Schiff was the Attorney General did a great disservice to the American people by misrepresenting entire sections of the report. And I think the fact that Schiff and some of these others will have the opportunity to work their way through the report and see it in its unredacted state will actually just provide further context, so that, you know, when they have the chance and the ability to work their way through it. And again, there's enough that I saw in here that falls well within, you know, the definitions from every constitutional lawyer that I've spoken to of Article 2, Section 4. They've got the grounds for impeachment if they decide they want to move forward.
And what specifically are those articles? What do those articles say? Which parts of the behavior by Trump would qualify there?
I think that, you know, and this is the first couple of lookovers, the thing that struck everybody probably the most is the obstruction of justice. I think that there really wasn't a pattern in there that showed true collusion, at least by the president himself. But there was definitive obstruction going all the way through it. In one particular section of the report, the special counsel's office actually noted that public comments that the president was making, and this was in the case of Paul Manafort's trial, would literally probably taint the jury pool going in, so that any statements that Trump was going to be making would actually probably in a very negative way impact any of the jury pools. As a matter of fact, since I have the thing up on screen, I'll read that one section. It's really quick because it's in the analysis, but this is what the special counsel says. The president's public statements during the Manafort trial, including during jury deliberations, also had the potential to influence the trial jury. On the second day of trial, for example, the president called the prosecution, quote, a terrible situation and a, quote, hoax that, quote, continues to stain our country, and then referred to Manafort as a, quote, Reagan doll darling who was, quote, serving solitary confinement, even though he was, quote, convicted of nothing. Those statements were widely picked up by the press, and while jurors were instructed not to watch or read news stories about the case and are presumed to follow these instructions, the president's statements during the trial generated substantial media coverage that could have reached jurors if they happened to see the statements or learned about them from others. So what the special counsel was basically saying was, the president's public utterances, okay, would influence the jury. Well, you know, we don't live in a perfect world with perfect justice, but there are people that would look at that as an effort by the president of the United States to obstruct the judicial process by tainting the jury pool. Now, I'm sure there's constitutional lawyers out there that probably pick up the phone and call us and say, oh, no, you're wrong. But the ones that I talked to, that was their impression.
Right. Got it. Well, let's, speaking of experts, let's bring on one of our own. I'd like to welcome to the show tonight Bryn Tannehill. And, of course, Bryn is the analyst and author that we have had on before. Bryn, welcome to the show.
Hey, how are you? Thank you for having me on again.
Oh, our pleasure. So what was your take on today? What was your reaction?
So Brody said this was a great day to be a journalist, and from my perspective as not a journalist, is this is a lousy day to be an American. What we see is essentially an administration that has leveraged its Department of Justice to act as its own personal defense attorney. We have seen an administration that was more than willing to work with the Russians if they thought they were going to get some leverage on candidate Hillary Clinton. We saw an administration that absolutely, at least 10 different times, appeared to be trying to obstruct justice by influencing the investigation. This was, and the fact that we're having a debate over whether or not we should impeach him just because we know that there's no way you can get 20 Republicans in the Senate to go for it, this is not good. This is actually kind of horrible when you've got figures from the Watergate affair saying, yeah, this is way worse than Watergate. This is far worse than anything that was in the investigation of Richard Nixon. And yet here we are just trying to figure out, okay, well, how do we live with this? That's kind of terrifying because it's indicative that the guardrails of democracy are down and there is no clear way to bring them back up.
Yeah, I hear you. And Brody, I know, is, you know, so on top of the process and the Constitution and the legality. The thing that struck me today was this kind of played out a little bit more like one of those tell-all books coming out rather than a legal case being set forward, where it created this portrait of this leader on top who was either brilliantly corrupt and or incredibly inept and stupid. The report leaning kind of towards the inept and stupid part, so much so that his staff was then making more appropriate choices. I don't know how completely appropriate, to shield him from being a complete washout and actually doing things that were definitively and irreparably illegal. Even to the point where Don Jr. wasn't charged, and the implication of everything I've seen was basically that because he was just too damn stupid. And that it was all just stupidity, not malfeasance. And anyway, so I hear you. And it is a depressingly sad time to be an American and to look up at our government and our leadership and see that as the character that we have on top. Brody, your thoughts?
Well, there's a, and I don't disagree with both of you. And of course, in full transparency, obviously, I'm Canadian, so my viewpoint and take on your government is slightly skewed. I'm also skewed by the fact that I'm a political journalist. But I don't disagree that it is a bad day because a lot of things, as Brent just pointed out, the guardrails went down. You kind of got a tenor for it, even with the notations in the report of, you know, when the president was actually told about the appointment of the special counsel. Reading from this section of the report, because this is classic, Sessions stepped out of the Oval to take a call from Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general, who told him about the special counsel appointment. Sessions then returned to inform the president of the news. According to notes that were written by Hunt, when Sessions told the president that a special counsel had been appointed, the president slumped back in his chair and said, quote, "Oh my God, this is terrible. This is the end of my presidency. I'm fucked." The president became angry and then lambasted the attorney general for his decision to recuse himself, stating, "How could you let this happen, Jeff?" And that's just one example of numerous examples throughout the course of the report. And the one thing I'm going to note here, I have got to give my colleagues at the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the outlets at, like Politico and Daily Beast and BuzzFeed that and the Huffington Post, all of these journalists who went digging, because nearly everyone I talked to today agreed with this. There weren't any real surprises in the report, only because of the reporting that had been going on previous to its release. So, in other words, we knew what was coming. And as a matter of fact, all the Mueller report basically did was substantiate the reporting of my colleagues. And they did a way above average job with this, but it also set the tenor. Yeah, absolutely. Don Jr. didn't get prosecuted. The special counsel took a pass. Although he coached it in very nice, polite terms, the bottom line was the special counsel determined that the president's oldest son was a moron and wasn't worth the effort. I also need to point out that with the release of this investigation and this report, there's something that's also people are overlooking. There are 14 other separate investigations going on, 12 of which were directly redacted in this report. This isn't over with yet. So if the White House thinks that they're in the clear on this, they are far, far, far from being in the clear. The other thing that I think needs to be pointed out, too, is that I think the Mueller report actually shows how absolutely corrupt and how absolutely dysfunctional this White House actually is.
I have a question for both of you in terms of the investigation. Now that even in a redacted form, it is essentially out there on the table. It seems to me that in both areas on the obstruction and the concept of collusion, that the conclusions drawn are not necessarily because there wasn't a crime there, there wasn't a there, but because nothing could be proven, because things were not in evidence, one of which was that Trump never allowed himself to be interviewed where his inconsistencies could have been scrutinized and some truth-telling could be come out of that. And I'll get to my main point of my question with both of you guys. It seems to me that Trump's own behavior, including, Brody, the statement you just made at the idea that this investigation was going to happen, that he was, quote-unquote, fucked, says to me that there was something more that had happened there that he was afraid that would come out that may not have actually been investigated. The other piece of it is his behavior with Putin and turning his eye on things that any other president would have come down on Russia about, to secret little meetings, to having things off the record. You know, all of that behavior, to me, says something more than the distance that seems to be implied in the report. Bryn, do you have a comment on that?
So a couple of things. First of all, is one of the things that just struck me is that it's now verified that, yes, the Russians were, or people claiming to represent the Russian government or Russian interests, were approaching the Trump campaign and offering them things. Any ethical campaign in this situation wouldn't have said, yeah, sure, let's see what you got. The correct answer is going to the FBI for them to start a counterintelligence operation. And that's what candidates in the past who have been put in situations where they've been approached with something unethical have immediately turned it over. Even previous Republican candidates have done that. And that's a bit discouraging, more than a bit discouraging. This shows just how vulnerable they are. You also mentioned how the Trump White House, you know, Brody thinks that they think they're in the clear. And I think they do think they're going to think that. And that's just going to encourage them to behave in even more egregious ways, which is going to further take down whatever guardrails might be left in place, or at least test them. And that's not good for America either. Finally, and this is something Brody and I chatted about over Messenger earlier, was buried in the footnotes is that the Trump White House possibility of tapes in a Russian hotel during Miss Universe pageant as if they potentially really did exist. And that was just like, oh my God, could you look any more guilty the way you reacted to this, trying to send out Michael Cohen to retrieve the tapes because you think they might be real? And Brody can comment on that, but yeah, this basically looks absolutely corrupt. But the funny thing is that I use my father, who's basically, I'm pretty sure, he's basically Archie Bunker that's going to die in front of, you know, the TV watching Fox News in his Barco lounger. He has denied vehemently that the Russians tried to influence the U.S. election or favored Trump. And finally, here's the report saying just that, that the Russians wanted Trump to win, and which agrees with what all the other intelligence community organizations' assessments were.
Brody, do you have a comment on the tapes that Bryn just brought up?
Well, I think that, you know, I think that her analysis is spot on. One of the things that we're probably going to have to be looking towards, and again, the general tenor of what happened today, you know, I'm Canadian, so I'm going to use a hockey reference. In hockey, there's a maneuver by players that we call a slap shot. It's a power stroke with your stick to shoot the puck in the direction to either another player or a net to do a score a goal. And I think what happened here is the special counsel has taken a slap shot, only the puck in this case is a report, and it's headed directly to Capitol Hill, and he's handing this one off to Congress. And I think that's really important to note, okay, that if you look at this, okay, one of the dynamics of this is that the special counsel wasn't exactly, apparently, certain that it was impossible, or it was possible, not impossible, but it was possible to indict a sitting president. But it, of course, based on the Constitution, again, Article 2, Section 4, the House would have the ability to impeach. So as long as the information that was in the report cleared the threshold of reasonable doubt, cleared the threshold of innuendo and gossip, and went into an evidentiary fashion that would actually stand up in a court of law, even though a congressional committee is not as such, or neither is the full Congress, that would be the pardon the pun, the bar that, you know, Mueller set for this thing. I don't know if Bryn's going to agree with me on that, but that's how I'm viewing it.
Well, so, I have a question for you. So go ahead, Bryn.
So just to add on to something Brody said here, and I think this is a really, really important point, and it also piggybacks onto something that Brody talked about earlier with Attorney General Barr's performance. Yes, absolutely, Mueller passed it off to Congress, but Mueller is also smart enough to know that Congress isn't going to be able to do anything with this. They can impeach in the House, but you'll never have the votes in the Senate, regardless of what President Trump does. The other thing to note was Attorney General Barr's performance is generally being panned, even by pundits. But two things to note. One, it's not people outside the Beltway aren't playing this inside the Beltway, inside baseball game with the Mueller report and dissecting like this. It's only its hardcore wonks who really want to dig into it like this. Most people are just looking at Fox News or whoever trying to get their sound bites, trying to get the gist. This is a 428-page legal report. And if you view what happened today with Barr and Mueller and the White House through the lens of Trump is trying to get reelected, and he's trying to do it by only winning his base and counting on the ability to suppress votes and to basically sling enough mud at whoever the Democratic nominee is that all he has to do is get 45% of the vote to win, then yes, what we saw today, as strange as it was, makes perfect sense. He was shoring up the base.
Right. So I want to go back to the point that you guys both alluded to. Actually, I'm going to dial it back a little bit to conversations Brody and I have had in the past about the specter of impeachment, the report, you know, what would be in it, how that could play out, and different scenarios. The thing that occurs to me is one thing that was always a question for me in those discussions, and that is the Pence factor. And as we know, Pence has been especially from the LGBT perspective and especially from the transgender community perspective, an absolute horror show. What was in those conversations that we had in the past was the speculation that if there was collusion with Russia, that collusion would have been around the whole campaign. The impeachment process potentially could take Pence with it, et cetera, et cetera. With this report and with the focus being more on the obstruction and not the collusion at all, and Mike Pence being not even involved there, should the miraculous happen, to your point, it's probably not going to, but that the House impeaches, the Senate somehow goes along with it, that would leave us with President Mike Pence. Will that be a factor in stopping this at the start, since obviously the House machine would not want that to be the end of conclusion in any case?
I'm going to, before Bryn gets into that one, because I know this is one of her points that she and I've talked about, here's the situation. As it sits now, once the articles of impeachment would clear through House Judiciary and go to the floor, and the president's impeached, the Senate is the trial factor. The real question that everybody is having at this point is whether McConnell would actually allow the Senate to have a trial. We think that he's not politically stupid enough to buck a Senate trial. By doing that, he would prompt such outrage that there would be literal, you know, torch marches in the streets, and it could get seriously ugly. So we don't think McConnell's that dumb. But to Bryn's point, if it does go into the trial process, it would be a show trial, and there really aren't enough Republican senators, at least at this point, that probably would be willing to convict and remove him from office. It's, you know, there's a threshold there that we really honestly, truly, you know, don't think that's going to happen. You have to also understand that there is some sort of bizarre hold that Trump has over the Republican Party, and particularly in the Senate. It's very difficult to explain. It's bizarre. So I think that while the House would probably go to impeachment, even though Speaker Pelosi has been resisting that for a long time, I think today's report issuance probably is a game changer. But again, I want to point attention to the fact that there are 12 other investigations going on right now, okay, that were fostered by the special counsel that still involve the president. They still involve the Trump Organization. They still involve the Trump campaign. This isn't over with yet. So at the end of the day, even if the House did not impeach and we ran the clock out on this, there is enough within the report and what has been revealed and what will probably be continued to be hashed out and revealed as my profession and the pundits in my profession beat the dead horse, that it probably could do significant enough damage to Trump's reelection effort. And I think at the end of the day, that's probably going to be the focus, at least by the Democrats. I don't think that anybody wants to really walk through an impeachment process, particularly with this guy. I think that the report in and of itself is probably enough to permanently cripple any effort he's going to have to launch a reelection effort. There's little nuggets in every section of this report. I'll give you another one. I'm quoting from the report. After Trump fired Comey in May 2017, then Deputy White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders told reporters in a press conference that, quote, the rank and file of the FBI had lost confidence in their director, prompting Comey's firing. When told by a reporter in the briefing that the vast majority of FBI agents supported the former director, Sanders responded that she had, quote, heard from countless members of the FBI that say very different things. When asked by the special counsel about the source of that statement, Sanders described the statement as a, quote, slip of the tongue made in the heat of the moment, quote, that was not founded on anything, end quote. So, in other words, she lied. So there's going
right.
to be folks that are going to be extrapolating all these little different nuggets. And I think at the end of the day, and Bryn, you can correct me if I'm wrong, I think at the end of the day, we're going to see this report as probably being able to at least cripple the president's reelection.
Okay, Brady, I want to go back to my question, though, because my question was if there was this path that we could somehow find with the House and the Senate to impeach when Pence is the prize at the end of that tunnel, would we want that even to succeed? In other words, wouldn't McConnell actually doing that dumb thing be actually a blessing in disguise? That's my question.
I mean, as far as Pence goes, Bryn, if you want to take Pence, I mean, I'll answer it real quick, okay? If Trump were removed and we're left with Pence, you have to look at the calendar and the clock of what's left. How much more damage can this administration do to the government of the United States? That really is what this boils down to. The answer is probably not much more. And here's the other part of it, okay? Pence is even more beholden, okay, to the Senate Republicans and the Senate Democrats, the Senate Republicans and the House Republicans than anything else. And the Democrats would probably be able to stymie his legislative efforts if there were any, because this process probably will take us right up to the threshold of the campaign, to be perfectly honest with you. Bryn?
So I'm generally in agreement with you about Pence. Let's just supposing for a moment that President Trump was impeached or stepped down or something. Pence would, they've already been cramming the courts as fast as they can with nominees who are far right, Federalist, Heritage Foundation, religious rights. They've already packed Health and Human Services and other agencies with appointees who are extreme religious right. They're already rolling back policies for transgender people and LGBT people as fast as they can. The DOJ is already attacking LGBT rights in court as hard as they can. If you had the Trump administration removed from office, I think that would, one, cripple whatever legislative agenda they might have. Two, it would cripple whatever Pence's ability to maneuver would be, just because it would be so unpopular at that point. And on top of that, I don't think that Pence is nearly as electable as Trump. He's not particularly charismatic. He comes across as kind of stiff in a kind of creepy kind of way, because he calls his wife mother and won't sit down to dinner with women or be in an elevator. He kind of squicks out people worse than Trump, and that's kind of saying something. So I'm not worried about Pence as much. But the one thing that I would point out is that I think perhaps one area I disagree with Brody on is that I think McConnell is less likely to bring this to trial if he's impeached in the House than Brody thinks, but Brody's better informed than me. He has better contact than me, but I can also see McConnell having already torn down guardrails and spit on them, doing it again because he doesn't care. My probabilities on this coming up for a trial in the Senate, I think, are probably a little bit lower in my estimation than Brody's.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, I mean, McConnell has, he sort of set the stage a little bit just on his refusal to let Garland come up for the Supreme Court. I mean, that was really, should have been a constitutional crisis right there. And so he's been at bat, and I'm not disputing it, Brody. I just, you know, it's like let me put it this way. Either way that it went, I don't know that I would be terribly shocked with McConnell.
Go ahead, Brent.
So one other thing to point out is, and I kind of alluded to this before, is that a lot of the smaller report stuff is very inside baseball. Something that I think, if we're just talking election 2020, it's going to have a bigger impact is where the economy is at that point. If nothing else happens, if this is it, if none of the other investigations pan out, I think that this is going to be more or less just kind of background noise about Trump, like every other thing that this administration has done that's not particularly nice or not particularly ethical. And there's so much that it just gets lost in the sea of awful.
I think that's true. Go ahead, Rob.
No, go ahead, Brody.
Well, the part of this that, and Bryn's has stated this, as Washington insiders, obviously we do have a rather skewed view of things. I think what's going to be really important in the weeks going forward is how our profession as journalists we're able to explain this entire process to the American people so that they have a base understanding of it. Yet the language of the report is very legal. I'll give you an example. On page 156, the special counsel was talking about overarching factual issues. I'm quoting the special counsel. First, the conduct involved actions by the president. Some of the conduct did not implicate the president's constitutional authority and raises garden variety obstruction of justice issues. Other events we investigated, however, drew upon the president's Article II authority, which raised constitutional issues that we address in Volume 2, Section B of the report. A factual analysis of that conduct would have to take into account both the president's acts, which were facially lawful, and that his position as head of the executive branch provides him with a unique and powerful means of influencing official proceedings, subordinate offices, and potential witnesses. So what happens there is someone like me or another smart fella has to come along and explain to mom-pop apple pie Chevrolet and Walmart customer in Lincoln, Nebraska, what does that mean? You know, there's a bottom line to this. And the bottom line, and this, a lot of this is, I think, more so than just my profession, I think Congress is going to have to be able to have some sort of clarification, as I said, for the folks in Lincoln, Nebraska, to be able to understand the impact of this. It's one thing for pundits like myself and Bryn to be able and have this kind of a conversation with you, but it's a thing entirely different to be able to explain this to mom, pop, apple pie, Chevrolet, and the Walmart customer so that they can clearly and precisely see, okay, how damaging it was. You know, Bryn pointed out earlier about the spin factor with, you know, Fox News, and that's absolutely correct. Fox News and the Attorney General are spinning it one direction, but that belies the truth of the report, even with the language I just used. The language I just used translates to the president obstructed justice. That's what it translates to. But there has to be a way to bridge that so that the public really truly understands that. I think it's inherent, again, and incumbent on my profession as well as members of Congress.
To that point, one report that I read, one opinion that was kind of put out there, was that because the press has actually been on this, and so much of this report has already, to your point earlier, Brody, so much of this has already been out there. This was, you know, there weren't a lot of surprises because it's been reported already, you know, and this is just validating that. But to the public that you're talking about, validation is not a big thing. You know, when you have Notre Dame burning up on their TV set, high drama is the thing that gets people's attention. And the speculation was that in this time in history, that this slow roll is actually going to play in Trump's favor, that that allows the spin by Barr to take place. It allows Fox News to kind of shore that up. And the people who are looking at it from either camp, on both sides, it's going to be kind of a, well, there's nothing new here, really. And life will just go on as is. Right, whereas in the past, a report like this coming out would have been, you know, a showstopper. Did Trump ride this out, is my question.
I think that in somewhat – go ahead, Bryn. Yeah, you take a shot at it first, then I'll follow up.
So what I'm seeing here is there's so much information out there and there's so many different markets that we're seeing kind of the Russian concept of Pravda, Izvestia, and Vrenyo, one of which translates as the ground truth, one of which Pravda translates as the truth from a certain point of view, and Vrenyo is essentially useful bullshit. The truth is probably that President Trump worked to obstruct the investigation, but convincing people that that's the actual truth, when you have, well, truth from a certain point of view is that, well, it wasn't enough to convict, and it wasn't enough to indict, and it wasn't enough to get a conviction in the Senate, and you spin it enough, and how true is it really? It's, you know, impossible to know. And then you have Fox News out there with, and frankly, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, as Brody noted, with Vrenyo, which is useful bullshit, which is lies that cloud the issue enough that people stop looking for the truth or cease caring. And I don't think that this is going to directly help the Trump campaign, but I'm confident that they're using these three concepts well enough that they're going to minimize the damage very, very effectively.
Well, I think the first step with that was the Attorney General of the United States standing at that podium and basically doing nothing more than being spin doctor this morning. I think really honestly at the end of the day, there's something I need to point out to here. You've got two divergent points of view on limitations on, first of all, presidential power, but more importantly, you know, can you indict a president and what exactly is going to protect, you know, the president overall? The special counsel said, and I'm quoting again, we were not persuaded by the argument that the president has blanket constitutional immunity to engage in acts that would corruptly obstruct justice through the exercise of otherwise valid Article II powers. Let me translate that into English. What the special counsel was basically saying is they felt that there were areas where the president did, in fact, engage in what would have been exercises of obstruction of justice. But the arguments that have been put forth, including by the Attorney General himself, even previous to his being nominated and then taking office, is that the president does have this constitutional immunity. So in other words, you know, you can't get the guy for this. Well, this is where the special counsel and the Attorney General parted ways. There, you have two completely separate viewpoints on it. Barr took his office with the viewpoint that you know, the president's got this kind of immunity, whereas the special counsel was saying, no, he doesn't. The thing that the special counsel did here was – rather than take it and leave it at the Justice Department, he transferred it to a co-equal branch of the government that under the Article 2, Section 4 provisions, and in fact under a lot of the Article 2 provisions, have at the end of the day the absolute authority to do something, and that's the Congress. So that's what Mueller basically did was he shifted it to the co-equal part of the government that would be able to do this, okay, only because of the fact that you've got opinions that have been written that a sitting president is entitled to immunity from indictment, okay, and that only a successor administration will be able to prosecute a former president, okay. But see, here's the thing. That doesn't look like that may in fact be the case, okay. And in this case, what's even more interesting, okay, is that the Attorney General himself holds the power, okay, of the criminal litigation for the entire government. In fact, that was decided, what was that, Supreme Court decision, U.S. versus Nixon. So, you know, this is what the problem has been with this particular thing, especially when you're looking at Trump. And I think that if you look at this report realistically, it lays the groundwork for an Article 2, Section 4 proceeding by the U.S. House. But then you get back to the same problem that you're still dealing with. I think that in many ways, when Speaker Pelosi made her statements now over a month ago that he wasn't worth the effort, I think that in many ways, maybe the Speaker was looking at that, knowing what I think the rest of us knew from the reporting and all the coverage that we'd already seen, that this was coming and this was where it was going to sit. It was coming up hard against the presidential campaign. And I think in many ways, what the Speaker and what some of the other people were looking at and may in fact still be looking at is that they're hoping that the American people, okay, will be the ultimate judge and jury on this nonsense, and that will be the end of the Trump administration. In other words, the good guys will win out. That's just one way of looking at it. I don't know, Brent.
So I agree with you here, but I want to throw something back at you, Brody, if I may, based
sure.
off of your experience. It's kind of one of the reactions that surprised me that it's gotten so little press, given that this revolves around Hillary Clinton. If you remember during the 90s, when questioned about Whitewater, Hillary answered with a lot of, I don't remember, I don't recall. And mm-hmm. the right wing went absolutely apoplectic about it. It was wall-to-wall
mm-hmm.
Rush Limbaugh making fun of her as, you know, either she's lying or she has Alzheimer's. Well, clearly she doesn't have Alzheimer's. Well, Trump answered something to the effect of, I don't remember, I don't recall, I don't know, 30 different questions posed on paper by Mueller. And
mm-hmm.
we're not seeing the left going after this. We're not seeing anybody pointing out that the right went absolutely apoplectic, and that was part of the reason why they wanted to impeach Clinton during the 90s over the same sorts of behavior. And going back even before that, I seem to recall that the Iran-Contra affair involved a lot of answers of I don't recall to questions by the special counsel. And the fact that those cases elicited such outrage, and this, it's not even a blip within the reaction to this report. What do you think?
I the one thing that has kind of surprised me has been the silence of the right today. I honestly expected them to be doing victory laps, and they didn't. And interestingly enough, you'll notice the left wasn't doing any victory laps either. I think that what's happening here is people are sobered by the fact that this report really, in very clear terms, in a black and white way, redactions or not, states the ultimate truth. And that is that the President of the United States sits at the top of a quasi-criminal enterprise. And there's no other polite way of putting it. And that there is a serious and severe difference of opinion as to how to best handle that. Now, to shore up what I just said, Here's the conclusion of the report, the last paragraph. And this is, again, the special counsel's words. Because we determined not to make a traditional prosecutorial judgment, we did not draw ultimate conclusions about the president's conduct. The evidence we obtained about the president's actions and intent presents difficult issues that would need to be resolved if we were making a traditional prosecutorial judgment. At the same time, if we had confidence after a thorough investigation of the facts that the president clearly did not commit obstruction of justice, we would so state. Based on the facts and the applicable legal standards, we are unable to reach that judgment. Accordingly, while this report does not conclude that the president committed a crime, it also does not exonerate him. Mm-hmm. So that's the summary. That's the last paragraph of the report. So I think that, again, what the special counsel did here was, because there was so much and there is so much divergence of legal opinion on this one, he slapshotted it to the hill, and he's basically leaving it to a co-equal branch of the American government to do something with it. The big question becomes, all right, exactly what is Congress going to do with this? I will say this. If Pelosi is persuaded by Maxine Waters, Adam Schiff, Jerry Nadler, other members of the caucus, and she allows the proceedings to ultimately end up in hearings, and then the articles of impeachment are carried to the floor, the next task will be to get past Mitch McConnell. And I'll be perfectly honest, I really think that's going to be a problem. Because remember, at the end of the day, the Senate trial is called for by your country's constitution, and based on his track record and history as Senate Majority Leader, is going to be left in one person's hands. And I'm not entirely sure that there are enough Republican senators that would push him to hold a trial. And I'm saying this quite clearly because at the end of the day, this may in fact be the breaking point where your country returns to the type of civil unrest and protests that we saw during the Vietnam era and even during Watergate, but more so Vietnam. This is a very clearly dangerous time for your government. And it's a very, you know, the special counsel made no bones about it. There's a lot of people who said there's nothing in this report. That's not true. That's the spin that the attorney general would have you believe. The truth of the matter is there's a lot to this report, okay? And again, the last sentence, while this report does not conclude that the president committed a crime, it also does not exonerate him. It's now up to the Hill. Brim?
Right. Well, actually, I have a point there, Brody, if you don't mind. I wanted to ask bigger picture in this situation where, to Brim's point, Trump is shoring up his base. Fox News comes around. The Republicans are ignore. The economy does fine for the next year and a half, et cetera. Today or this week, we had a situation in the Democratic primary where the Sanders campaign basically came out nasty against the competition there and is almost threatening kind of the nuclear option of, Bernie or bust. Will that kill us? Will that put Trump back in the office?
I'm going to say absolutely. Starting interesting fighting between different left-wing factions is so freaking easy. I'm watching it on my social media feeds whenever any of the candidates come up and setting off a fight of screw it, I'll stay home over any one thing that a candidate has done. And that's just talking LGBT issues. I know people who will stay home for Harris because she didn't support a transgender prisoner's right to get a gender confirmation surgery. I know people that will stay home for Buttigieg because he has said that he's not sure he would have commuted Chelsea Manning's sentence. I know there's people, I've had issues with the fact that Elizabeth Warren voted to confirm Ben Carson, despite his lack of experience and horrifically transphobic and homophobic statements while he was at Johns Hopkins University, along with Johns Hopkins' troubling past with trans people. But just seeing how people are immediately jump to, here's something the candidate did, I'm going to sit this one out, and some polling data on Sanders voters about Buttigieg that just came out today kind of confirms this, that something like only 76% of Sanders voters would vote for Warren and only 79% would vote for Buttigieg, whereas conversely, 100% of the Buttigieg voters that they interviewed or polled would vote for Sanders. So there's maybe a ray of hope in there somewhere.
Yeah, I think there is a ray of hope, Rob, but I think that one of the things that is going to be extremely problematic is what I call the balkanization of progressive politics. And the thing that's doing more to kill it than anything else are the purity tests. And, you know, it's one of those things where this has nothing to do with the right. This has nothing to do with the center. This has to do with the fact that you're not going to find the perfect ideal candidate, and you're not going to find a candidate that meets, you know, every little box that needs to be ticked off. So that means you're going to have to compromise. Traditionally, the left has always had a hard time doing that without a really bloody battle. And as we've been looking at the numbers, there's still the elephant in the room, and that's the one that hasn't declared, and that's the former vice president of the United States. So it'll be interesting going forward.
No, yeah, I agree it'll be interesting, but my point there is that while, you know, we noodle on what the next steps of this report is, and Brody, to your point, different lawsuits coming up and the fate of the Trump administration, to Brin's point, if they shore up just their base, ignore everything else, which they don't seem bizarrely to have a problem doing, that our bigger problem is back in our own house. Because I think that's the thing that will lose the whole thing for us and hand this back for four more years to somebody who is clearly and thoroughly unqualified, undeserving, and dangerous. With that, I want to thank you both for tonight, giving analysis of what has happened, and I think a pretty unique LGBTQ spin, which was actually pretty important. Brin, thank you so much, as always. And for our listeners who have not gotten this yet, you do want to go immediately to Amazon, get Brin's book, give it to people. It is probably the best piece out there to having people understand what the transgender experience is about and answers pretty much every question you possibly could have. I want to thank Brody for being on board as always. Brody and I will be back next week, same channel, same time, and also catch Out in Santa Cruz Saturday night on www.kseo.com. That's 7 p.m. Pacific time, 10 p.m. Eastern time, and you will hear more LGBT relevant material for the team here. I want to thank you so much. And bid you a very pleasant good evening.
You've been listening to Rated LGBT Radio.